She's the first female veteran elected to the U.S. Senate from any state. This hour, a conversation with Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We start this Politics Wednesday with a conversation I had with Senator Ernst that was recorded yesterday morning. She shared her views on the president's feud with a Gold Star family, on the future of Obamacare, and on the chances for tax reform. Then we'll be joined by political analysts Dave Anderson and Jonathan Haseed of Iowa State University. They'll react to Ernst, but also give us their take on the flurry of big political developments just within the last 24 hours. Politics Day is just ahead. First, this news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. A little bit different today. Coming up in just a moment, a conversation recorded yesterday morning with U.S. Senator Joni Ernst of Iowa. Recorded before that flurry of big developments in Washington. A little later, Jonathan Haseed and Dave Anderson of Iowa State University will join us as our political analysts. But first, this conversation I had yesterday morning with Senator Ernst before the big bombshells out of Washington, the renewed Trump-Corker feud, that momentous speech on the Senate floor by Senator Jeff Flake, also the repeal of a banking rule that would let consumers band together to sue their bank or credit card company to resolve disputes. Shame we didn't have Senator Ernst's reaction to those big stories. Came a little after our conversation. Here is my conversation from yesterday morning with Senator Joni Ernst.
Senator Ernst, welcome back to our program.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Let's talk about the tax overhaul. Last week, the Senate approved a budget resolution setting the stage for tax overhaul legislation. At this point, the House is expected to take up the Senate budget as is. They might do that later this week. Now, the Senate bill allows for a $1.5 trillion increase to the deficit. The House bill would require the budget to be deficit neutral. We should note here, Senator, that we're taping this conversation before a Tuesday lunch that the president is having with lawmakers on this topic, so there could be significant developments in the next 24 hours. Let me ask, on what specific points do you see the biggest challenges in bringing the Senate, the House, and the White House visions for tax reform together?
Well, I think exactly what you just expressed, the differences between the Senate and the House. But the one thing to recognize, and there are a number of issues that we are agreed upon, and one is that we have to do better for our lower-income, middle-income wage earners, as well as simplifying the tax code. By simplifying the tax code, we would really put our middle-class Iowans and small businesses in our state on a level playing field. So those are some of the things that will bring us together, and I hope that we can focus on those things between the House and the Senate, which will make life better for our constituents. We do have some significant challenges, but I feel in the end, our Iowans will benefit by this tax reform package.
Can you be a little more specific on the middle class tax cut and those in the lower income brackets? How much people can expect in certain brackets, or aren't you into that detail yet?
Well, not into that detail yet, because we haven't seen the actual bracket set in stone yet. And so what we're trying to do is look at what are individuals paying in taxes now, and can we lower that percentage rate even more? And that's what we're hopeful. But then also doubling the standard deduction is also very, very important, and that will provide a huge lift for our lower and middle class Iowans. Just by doubling that makes such a big difference. When we looked back at 2015, over 70% of our Iowa taxpayers took the standard deduction rather than itemizing. So we feel that just even doing that and in a small amount really will make a big difference for those in those lower brackets.
Senator, the Senate bill allows for a $1.5 trillion increase to the deficit. Now, Republicans were also talking a lot about concerns over the deficit during the Obama era. Isn't that a concern now, a $1.5 trillion increase to the deficit?
It is a concern, and we have to look at this in a long game scenario. This is not, you know, a sprint by any means, but when we are looking ahead by making these tax rates competitive, whether it's, you know, trying to bring dollars back in from overseas, whether it's lowering the brackets for our low and middle income earners, just simplifying the tax reform, we do anticipate this will help the economy. When I have more Iowans that have dollars they can keep in their own pockets rather than sending it into the IRS, they will help stimulate the economy, or they will pay for those needed items for their families. So we see it as a long game again. We can't just focus necessarily on the short term, but what this will do in the outlying years. It is a concern, I admit that, but mm-hmm. we want to spur economic growth in the United States.
Mm-hmm. What about the richest in this country, in our state, the richest 1% of the United States? What will they have a tax cut under this plan?
You know, we are looking at that, and I would rather see, of course, the tax cuts directed at our middle and lower income wage earners. I think that is really, really important. Overall, certainly we can look at that top 1%, but what we don't want to do is hold our middle and low income wage earners captive, dependent upon what we do with that top 1%.
So it sounds like they may get a tax cut as well, the richest 1%.
It is possible, but again, we haven't seen that yet. There is some discussion there. What I would like to see, of course, is that we are focusing on our middle-income folks. You know, they're where the rubber meets the road. They're out there working, many of them multiple jobs. Those are the folks that we need to focus on.
And you defined middle-income earners, and I know the brackets haven't been defined yet, but what do you, Joni Ernst, define as a middle-income earner?
Well, in my home community, median income, of course, is about $46,000 mm-hmm. a year. And so my perspective is a lot different than somebody from another state. But, you know, we'll take a look at that. We're going to have to run the numbers, though. We've got to run the numbers and see how this is all working out. It will be good. Once we've heard from the president, and as you stated, we'll be joining him shortly, but once we've heard from the president, we come together between the House and the Senate, we can get all of this ironed out. But again, we'll want to make sure that our Iowans are benefiting from the budget reform, the tax reform package that we see coming forward.
It sounds like you are joining the president for that lunch.
I will be, yes, I will be. I'm really interested to hear what he has to say. I think it's important that we're all working together on this. But we haven't reformed our tax code since about 1986 was the last major overhaul that we had. I think we're due for that. We really want to spur economic growth. And, of course, I think it's pretty interesting that if we look at last year, real personal income in Iowa increased by only 0.5%, and our real median income declined over 4%. So what we want to do is focus on the middle class folks and make sure we can do better for them. But let's get our economy going. Let's make sure that there are jobs available out there. Everything needs to go hand in hand.
Okay, Senator Ernst, I know we have limited time. There are three or four things I wanted to get to, just so you know, we probably can't dwell on the next topics as much as we gave attention to tax reform there. I wanted to talk about the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
As you know, Iowa was seeking a waiver from the federal government that would allow it to implement an entirely new subsidy structure. I guess the goal there was to reduce premiums, expand coverage options. Mm-hmm. But after months of no answer from the Trump administration on whether the waiver would be approved, open enrollment staring us in the face, state officials yesterday announced that they're pulling the waiver application. What does the end of this Iowa stopgap plan mean for Iowans?
Well, it means that Iowans are going to face very steep increases in their insurance market. And I would say it wasn't because of Trump administration slowing down the process. We had an open comment period, and by the rules of Obamacare, they have to keep that open comment period open, and it just closed on the 20th. So they got right back to us excuse me, as far as the administration and Administrator Seema Verma. We've been working with her all along, but they had to wait for the comment period to close. And unfortunately, the numbers were not going to work out. Again, we have to work within the current framework of Obamacare when moving through the waiver. And there's just not enough flexibility allowed in the waiver right now for the Iowa stopgap method to go into place. And so I'm disappointed, but we do continue to move forward.
Right. If Medicas, and the one insurer Medica is the one willing to sell Obamacare plans in Iowa next year, if their marketplace premiums go up by the 50% increase that they have indicated, isn't that something that Congress, a Republican Congress, could and should have prevented by moving quickly on changes to the ACA, changes you were seeking earlier this year? Isn't there responsibility, blame to go to your party in not acting on the ACA and getting us into this position?
No, and I would say that if you look back, of course there is failure because we were not able to repeal and replace Obamacare earlier this year. I voted three times for the repeal, the replace. I'm on the Alexander Murray bipartisan bill for just kind of a stopgap, a patch bill for the next 2 years. That has not been brought up for a vote yet in the in their committee or on the floor. But if you go back, the past 3 years before the Trump administration came into office, past 3 years, rates have increased 110% on the individual market. And that's with the existing Obamacare. And so we've known for about 8 years that there have been issues, but Congress has not acted. And that's why I do believe we need to allow our states greater flexibility when working with these plans, because we know at the state level they can make changes quickly, where the federal government cannot. So Iowa continues to be in a really, really difficult spot. Those that are on the individual insurance market really have no choice at all. They either pay the outrageous fees and premiums associated with those plans, or they simply don't get covered. And I've heard from so many families now that simply can't afford the coverage anymore. So we're in a pickle. We've got to figure out a way forward. And hopefully we can do that in the upcoming years. I am hopeful that we'll take a look at the Alexander Murray bill. I am a co-sponsor on that bill, so is Senator Chuck Grassley. This may allow Iowa greater flexibility in the future, but unfortunately, we just haven't seen it yet.
The president has gone back and forth on the Alexander Murray bipartisan deal. I suppose you'll find out at lunch where he's at today on that, because he does shift.
He does, and that's been a real frustration, too, is that Iowans need relief now. They need relief now, and we need partners in making sure we are protecting Iowans. If the goal of Obamacare was to make sure that everybody was covered by affordable insurance, it has failed. So we need to do something about it. We've got to come together. We've got to realize it's failing in certain states. Iowa is one of those. So if we can look at whether he's using his executive orders and moving quickly on those, or whether we as Congress need to move even quicker, we've all got to get this figured out, because it's not doing our families any good.
Senator Ernst, in the few minutes we have remaining, I wanted to go to another topic in the news. Also to mention, you served our country many years as a lieutenant colonel in the Iowa Army National Guard. In fact, you're the first female veteran elected to the U.S. Senate from any state. You were deployed in Kuwait during the Iraq War. What do you make of the feud over what is appropriate to say to the grieving, a grieving spouse when a soldier is killed in action? Is this how you would expect the president to handle condolences of a fallen service member, the back and forth questioning of a Gold Star family?
Right. And I you know, my heart goes out to that young widow. We lost four brave souls, and I wish that we could focus on those four wonderful men that lost their lives. I wish we could focus on the families and just support them in their time of grief. And I wish the back and forth would stop, and that whether it's the president, whether it's the media, whether it is this congresswoman, let's focus less on a condolence call. Let's focus on the fact that everybody handles grief differently. I am glad that the president made a phone call of condolence. Other presidents maybe will write a letter. You know, they need to figure out what is right for them. Mm-hmm. But I wish that we would stop the back and forth. Let's focus on those four young men that lost their lives. They deserve nothing less than our absolute respect and admiration.
Niger, where these four young men died, is a place many of us had never heard of up until a few days ago. And it's revealed that many members of Congress say they didn't know we had hundreds of troops active in West Africa. Were you surprised? You're on the Armed Services Committee. Were you surprised?
No, I'm not surprised at all. And I do have oversight of United States Special Operations Command, and these four young men are part of Special Operations Command. We have operators in many, many countries around the world, and they're not involved directly in combat actions. What they do is a train, advise, and assist mission. They help locals fight against ISIS. So the American people shouldn't be surprised. We have all kinds of soldiers, airmen, Marines, sailors around the globe supporting many different initiatives against the fight on the war on terror. Mm-hmm. So I know that we have troops in Africa. I think it's important to recognize that. The families know that their loved ones are deployed, and I was married to an Army Ranger who deployed many places around the world, and it was just important that the public not necessarily know where our husbands were deployed. So I think that there is a certain level of expectation of transparency with where our men and women are, but at the same time, we absolutely need to protect them as well, and by releasing too much information does put these souls in jeopardy. And so we have to find the appropriate balance. I think General Dunford said that quite well yesterday, that the American public, they do need to understand what's going on. However, we can't release every single detail about every single mission that exists out there. That does truly put these men at jeopardy, and we don't want that.
Senator Ernst, we're getting a signal from your people. We have 1 minute, if it could allow me one more question here. The president has been in office now for 9 months. How would you characterize the president as a negotiator and a deal maker after 9 months in office? This was, after all, the chief skill that he campaigned on.
You bet. I think he's great at negotiating. Congress, however, we are the ones that need to follow through. And I can be a very harsh critic at times of the administration. I can be a harsh critic of Congress. We have got to step up. It is up to us to get these bills over the finish line. It is up to us to make sure we are fixing Obamacare, to make sure that we are getting the tax reform done. And for heaven's sakes, we've got infrastructure being queued up as well. And so we have to focus on our job, and we have to make sure that we are getting it across the finish line for the American people. I think the president has given us a lot of great ideas, but we all need to pull together as one team to ensure that they do get done for the benefit of our citizens.
And with that as an on your agenda, what are your chances of success now going forward?
I feel very good, especially about tax reform. I think this is one that we can do. I think infrastructure, we're going to have so many partners on that particular package as it comes up, Democrats and Republicans, and I think a lot of good ideas will stem from that. And hopefully, in a spirit of working together, we'll be able to get a number of other things done as well.
U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, we appreciate your time, Senator. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That conversation recorded yesterday morning with Senator Ernst. It was recorded before the big flurry of political developments in Washington. Above all, that momentous speech on the Senate floor by Senator Flake. Also some a repeal of a banking rule that has significance. Jonathan Hasid is with us, Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, back to sort of a normal politics Wednesday here. We have a welcome to our program, Assistant Professor of Political Science, you both at Iowa State University. You're sitting in the same studio, Jonathan and Dave. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
And we have about 4 minutes before we have to take a break in the 4 minutes, and then we'll come back and talk about the other things that happened later in the day yesterday. I want to get your reactions to some of the things that Senator Ernst said there. Let me go to you, Dave Anderson. What jumped out at you from that conversation?
Well, I really like listening to Senator Ernst talk, especially when she talks about the military. I think she's got a great perspective on the military. I do wish she would kind of take a little bit more responsibility for the Republicans in Congress. You asked a pretty tough question there about what about Obamacare? There are problems that need to be fixed, and, you know, Congress is not fixing them. And she deferred a little and said, well, you know, it's not just a problem this year. It's been a problem for 3 years. Well, yeah, but the Republican Party has had unified control of Congress for 3 years.
Right, and they hammered on repeal and replace for 7 years.
Yeah, and in the 7 years that Obama was president and Republicans had a loud voice in Congress, they continually passed legislation to fully repeal. But then when it was actually possible to do it, you got a Republican president, the bill didn't materialize. It's like the party really didn't have a plan. They just had a campaign strategy.
I was interested in her comments there at the very end, talking about the president's negotiating skills and leadership. She more or less wanted to play it into the Trump narrative that it's not my fault, reversing that. The buck stops here, doesn't stop at the president's desk. He cast blame on Congress, and she eagerly took up that blame.
You know, I'll echo her on that. Congress is the branch that legislates. The president has very clearly said, and if you listen to his words, he's very clearly indicated that he really does not have strong policy preferences. He wants to sign legislation, and anything that Congress passes about Obamacare, he is likely to just sign. But Congress does not seem to be working in a functional manner right now.
Jonathan Haseeb, what did you take out of that conversation with Senator Ernst?
Well, just quickly getting back to this Obamacare question, I mean, it is true, of course, that Congress has to pass the legislation, as Dave has just said. But, you know, Trump campaigned on this idea that only he can fix it, that he was this master negotiator and master deal maker, and that he could get anything through Congress that he wanted. And we've shown so far that hasn't happened. The other interesting thing that I took away from Senator Ernst's comments were in her eagerness of her and the whole Republican Party to pass these tax cuts, in spite of the fact that they're likely to add a huge amount to the deficit. This, again, is a party that's campaigned on reducing the deficit, on excoriating Obama for being in charge when the U.S. deficit increased hugely. And now they seem to be willing to throw all that orthodoxy out the window.
Right. I asked her about that, and she said it was a concern, but said sort of we're in it for the long game.
Certainly. In general, though, by most economic indicators, the economy is doing quite well. We seem to be roaring along. Unemployment is at a low in for many decades. It strikes me that perhaps by previous Republican orthodoxy, this wouldn't be a good time to hugely increase the deficit. You want maybe increase the deficit when times are bad, but not necessarily when times are so good. Well, we'll have to see.
Okay, we'll be back in just a minute with Jonathan Haseeb of Iowa State University, Dave Anderson, also of Iowa State University, our political analysts, when we come back to pick apart the shockwaves that were sent through D.C. yesterday by Republican Senator Jeff Flake and his speech on the Senate floor, his announcement he will not run for re-election, and also his announcement he will not be complicit, his words. Also the reignited feud between Senator Corker, the GOP senator, and President Trump. And also how the Republican Senate narrowly voted yesterday to repeal a banking rule that would let consumers band together to sue their bank or credit card company to resolve financial disputes. That tiebreaker had to be decided by the vice president. Also, what the new Chinese Politburo means for our relations with the world's most populous nation. Dave Anderson with us, Jonathan Haseeb, more political analysis. It's Politics Wednesday on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a Politics Wednesday edition. Great deal of the first half taken up with a conversation I had with Senator Joni Ernst. We want to concentrate on the last 24 hours in the final few minutes, the final half of our program. Dave Anderson with us and Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University, where they're both assistant professors of political science and two of our very able pool of political analysts from Iowa's universities and colleges. Well, gentlemen, let's talk about the political bombshell, first of all, that Republican Senator Jeff Sessions dropped yesterday. It was a 17-minute speech where you could hear his emotion throughout. He announced at the end he would not seek re-election for his seat in Arizona. He called on fellow members of Congress and American citizens not to be, in his words, complicit in allowing the current state of politics to become the new normal. Flake said that Trump was unfit for office, warned that his actions were degrading and dangerous to the country. So let's listen to a little bit of the 17-minute-long statement from the Senate floor. This is just over a minute of that 17 minutes.
Without fear of the consequences and without consideration of the rules of what is politically safe or palatable, we must stop pretending that the degradation of our politics and the conduct of some in our executive branch are normal. They are not normal. Reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior has become excused and countenanced as telling it like it is, when it is actually just reckless, outrageous, and undignified. And when such behavior emanates from the top of our government, it is something else. It is dangerous to a democracy. Such behavior does not project strength, because our strength comes from our values. It instead projects a corruption of the spirit and weakness. It is often said that children are watching. Well, they are. And what are we going to do about that? When the next generation asks us, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you speak up? What are we going to say?
Okay, Senator Jeff Flake, Republican from Arizona, attacking the president's president and also giving warnings to not only his congressional colleagues, but to the United States and democracy. Wow, the gravity in his voice, struggling through parts of that. Let me go to you first, Jonathan Hasid. What does this represent, this speech by Jeff Flake?
Well, you know, certainly it's unprecedented, at least in recent memory. You know, I suspect that what we're seeing is the slow motion breakup of the Republican Party, at least as it was constituted before. Trump and his loyalists are essentially taking over the party. They have different priorities than conservatives like Jeff Flake did. Last year he released a book entitled "Conscience of a Conservative," which echoed previous Senator Barry Goldwater's book of the same title. And, I think he's trying to take a stand on what the Republican Party believes in. And, for better or worse, the Republican Party has essentially moved on from people like Jeff Flake, or at least that's how it seems.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that, Dave Anderson? Are the populist nationalists, the nativists, some people say, taking over the GOP? And this is just one more of the kind of slow motion falling apart of the GOP or split in the GOP?
I think more than a falling apart, it's really kind of an evolution of the GOP, because it's not that the GOP has attracted a new group of voters in. It's that this has been a really stable group of voters within the Republican Party and has really served as the source of energy for the party for at least 8 years now. And the people they were electing into office weren't really doing what they wanted them to. You have the base, who is very populist in its nature and very nativist, who wanted strong action to restrict immigration. And the Republican Party really didn't do much to achieve that, at least not the elected officials. They wanted things to help the middle class. And they heard in campaign speeches that tax cuts would help them. And then when Republicans got into power, they would do tax cuts that were heavily tilted towards the rich. And I think the Republican base got very frustrated with this, because what they were asking their elected leaders to do was not what those elected officials were doing once they were in power. And what we're seeing now is that the base is electing people that actually does what they want them to.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Flake said on CNN he thinks more of his Republican colleagues in the Senate will speak out about Trump in the days and weeks to come. his words, I think we've hit a tipping point at some point. Just the weight of it causes people to change and say, I can't take this anymore. I hope that we've reached that point. I wonder, Jonathan, will fellow lawmakers, do you see any signs that they'll answer his call, or seems more like to me, from what I'm observing, business as usual?
Yeah, I suspect business as usual. I mean, the ones who have spoken out are, people who are not seeking re-election, like Senator Flake. Apparently, in the latest approval ratings, he was around 17% approval, so unlikely to get re-elected. Senator Corker from Tennessee last week, had similar sentiments, also not seeking re-election. And people like George W. Bush, who spoke out also recently, without mentioning Trump by name, spoke out on the decline of civility in American politics, obviously as someone not seeking political office. And so I find it unlikely that, let's say, sitting senators and congressmen who are, seeking re-election are likely to break with the president this vocally. I don't see it happening.
Mm-hmm. So the president defending himself today against this astonishing criticism leveled by Corker and Flake yesterday, insisting that support on Capitol Hill for his presidency amounts to, in his words, a love fest. He accused the senators of acting so hurt and wounded. Here are a couple of his tweets from this morning. The reason Flake and Corker dropped out of the Senate race is very simple. They had zero chance of being elected. Act so hurt and wounded. Second tweet this morning. The meeting with Republican senators yesterday outside of Flake and Corker was a love fest with standing ovations, great ideas for the USA. His second tweet today. Let's listen to more of the White House angle on this. Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders in a press briefing yesterday that the words of Flake and Corker would have little effect on the president.
Look, I think the voters of these individual senator states are speaking in pretty loud volumes. I think that they were not likely to be reelected. And I think that shows that the support is more behind this president than it is those two individuals.
Okay, let's go right to Senator Corker. Following a renewed Twitter spate between these two politicians, Corker and President Trump. Senator Corker said to a reporter yesterday that President Trump has, in his words, great difficulty with the truth and that he would not support him if he ran in the next presidential election.
Everything you said today was absolutely untrue.
You said he's an untruthful president. Yeah, are you calling him?
No question.
Yeah, no question. I mean, we grew up in our family not using the L word, okay? They're provable untruths. Provable. On the Iran deal, everybody knows their role I played there, and they're working with me, interestingly, right now, on tax reform. I made the deal with Toomey that, has allowed that to go forward. Obviously, I want to make sure it's done properly, but. And then everything else, I mean, four times he encouraged me to run and told me he would endorse me. So I don't know. It's amazing. Unfortunately, I think world leaders are very aware that much of what he says is untrue. Certainly people here are, because these things are provably untrue. I mean, they're just factually incorrect, and people know the difference. So I don't know why he lowers himself to such a low, low standard and debases our country in the way that he does, but he does. And, look, I don't like responding. I you can let them go unanswered, but and it's just not me to. We don't do tweets like that. We've responded twice to, again, untruths, but, it's unfortunate that our nation finds itself in this place.
Okay, Senator Bob Corker. Where does this leave us, the rest of the Republican Party, Senator Corker, Flake, Ben Sasse in our neighboring Nebraska? Also, when we talk about Senator Ernst and Senator Grassley, what I guess you could call now the mainstream GOP, even though they are very conservative voters in the GOP, Ernst and Grassley certainly not in the category of harsh critics of Trump. We heard some sort of tempered criticism of the president's actions there in the first half by Senator Ernst. Paint out, what are the scenarios you see going forward before we move on with a couple of other things? Jonathan.
Well, you know, I suspect that that Trump will be able to, you know, in influencing primaries and things, will be able to essentially bend the GOP to his will. You know, even if the senators don't like what he's doing and congressmen don't like what he's doing privately, I can't imagine that too many more of them are going to challenge him publicly.
Mm-hmm. Dave, your predictions here?
Well, I think we're going to see a lot of...
Yeah, I'm asking you for predictions at a time when 24 hours ago we couldn't have predicted this.
True. But I think we'll see a lot of the same thing continuing. President Trump seems to really enjoy kind of picking on individual GOP senators one at a time, and they seem to slowly turn against him. But the fact is, the members of the Republican Party in both chambers of Congress agree with at least 85% of the president's agenda. I mean, we've got now three sitting senators, McCain, Corker, and Flake, who have come out strongly against the president, but they all vote almost 90% with his agenda. So we're going to see a war of words in some ways, but it probably won't change what's happening in Congress very much.
Dave Anderson and Jonathan Haseeb with us, our political analysts today from Iowa State University. Let's move on to the Republican-led Senate yesterday, narrowly voting to repeal a banking rule that would let consumers band together to sue their bank or credit card company, this to resolve financial disputes. It was the Vice President, Pence, casting the final vote to break that 50-50 tie. Now, the banking industry has been lobbying hard to roll back the regulation from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's a new bureau. It moves to President Trump's desk for a signature. Perhaps his signature is already on it. I haven't looked at the latest news. The GOP's argument here was that the rule harmed the free market. Democratic lawmakers said the rule was needed and would give consumers more leverage to stop companies from financial wrongdoing. Jonathan, can you... kind of give us your perspective on the significance of eliminating this rule?
Sure. You know, the idea that it's somehow a restriction on the free market by letting people sue in the courts is ludicrous on its face. Binding arbitration, banks love it because nobody uses it. I saw one study that suggested that last year against financial institutions, it was only used 79 times, resulting in a total verdict of about $400,000. And, you know, these are against multi-billion-dollar corporations, in the case of things like Wells Fargo, ones that have been provably done lots of fraudulent activity, been fined many hundreds of millions of dollars. And the idea that it's somehow a restriction on the free market by letting consumers sue in the courts when they're wronged is just preposterous.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Dave, this is an Obama-era rule for the little guy. I think what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau created in Obama's era. Now we have a president who ran on a populist platform, ostensibly for the little guy as a populist, for the working class, apparently siding with the banks. Is that the way you see this?
Yeah, that's absolutely accurate. This is one of those areas where the GOP establishment and the GOP base are clearly at odds with each other. The populist sentiment here would be, you know, the big banks are kind of out to get the little guy. They prey on the fact that most people don't understand the complexity of financial decisions. They overwhelm their consumers with fees, with penalties, and at times it looks like they outright cheat consumers.
Right. When we compare it with another populist, Bernie Sanders, we cannot in a million years imagine Bernie Sanders saying, OK, let's roll back this rule.
No, this is something Bernie Sanders would advocate for. And in a lot of sense, I think if Donald Trump said this in a rally, like, hey, we're going to get those big banks and we're going to let the little guy sue him, his supporters would go crazy for this. They would love this. But it's not conservative. Conservatism says you don't regulate the free market. You let businesses do what they want. And if consumers don't like that, consumers will go somewhere else.
Okay, so the political rhetoric not matching the action if the president signs this. Consequences, Dave? Consequences this next time around?
None.
When the talk doesn't match the walk?
There will be almost no consequences because—
Probably forget it next week because 1,000 things will have happened.
That, and also there's kind of a difficulty within the GOP base right now in that the only place they're going to hear about this is the mainstream media, and they don't trust the mainstream media. And they might hear about it through academics or research, but they don't trust academics or research. There are very few avenues for real, true populist Republicans to get an accurate story about this.
Mm. Let's finish up, Jonathan. I know this is the focus of your work and your interest. China and China's new Politburo Standing Committee introduced at the Great Hall of the People in Beijing. The ruling Communist Party unveiling its next generation of leaders. Seven men now making up the Politburo Standing Committee. That's the country's top decision-making body. What is the makeup of the new Politburo? What's been happening in China the last few days say to you about China's direction?
Sure. So this was the conclusion of the 19th Party Congress, something obvious. This is the 19th one. They happen every 5 years. The big signal coming out of this is that Xi Jinping, China's president and general secretary of the Communist Party, has clearly consolidated his control further. One of the unusual things is that normally at this time we would have expected him to have nodded to or anointed some kind of successor, and he hasn't done that. And so it's really ramping up speculation that he's going to want to seek another five-year term, an unprecedented five-year term again in 2022. And so it's really suggesting that Xi Jinping has really increased his grip on the Chinese Communist Party and put his loyalists in various high positions. And no one can stop him now inside China.
So what does this mean, his leadership, the new Chinese Politburo, what does that mean for U.S. relations with this, the world's most populous nation?
I suspect that China is going to get even more aggressive in terms of its foreign policy. Xi Jinping announced that China was entering a new era. So the first era was with Mao Zedong, with the founding of the Chinese Communist Party and beginning in 1949. The second era was Deng Xiaoping when he started doing reform and opening in the late 1970s. And this is the third era where China, you know, rejoins what it sees as its rightful place on the world stage. And so I suspect we're going to see things like more artificial island building in the South China Sea. I suspect we're going to see more Chinese pushback against American leadership in the region.
What about our face-off with the North Koreans? With the North Korean leadership, I should say.
Sure. The Chinese leadership is practically as frustrated with the North Korean leadership as everybody else. The idea that, I mean, yes, China supports North Korea, but actually the two countries hate each other's guts. The North Koreans see the Chinese as a bunch of meddling imperialists, and the Chinese see the North Koreans as a bunch of backward idiots. And so they don't get along at all. And essentially, the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, has done all he could to kind of thumb his nose in Xi Jinping's face. Xi is apparently furious, but the prospect of a collapsed North Korea or a North Korea that is absorbed by South Korea and becomes a U.S. ally is even more frightening to the Chinese leadership than preserving the status quo.
For the final minute, let's zoom back into Iowa politics. I'll get your reaction to Republican Governor Kim Reynolds. She hosted her first annual Harvest Festival fundraiser on Saturday, featured supportive remarks from Republican allies, a rousing speech from the governor herself. Let's listen to the tone and the words of this little excerpt from it.
As we all know, as we travel the state, the liberals are unhinged, and they are out for us. And we need to double down and do all we can. And if you keep fighting, I'll keep fighting. Let's keep this united team together because, my gosh, we want to build on the successes that we've seen this last legislative session. And we want to keep Iowa moving forward. We don't want them to come in and reverse the good work that we've done.
Okay. Governor Reynolds, liberals unhinged. Dave Anderson, not exactly the words of someone who would like to unify the state, is it?
No, not at all. But it is the voice of somebody who is doing a really good job of getting her campaign moving. Kim Reynolds is going to face probably a really strong challenge in the primary. And the Harvest Rally?
Yes, Harvest Festival.
The Harvest Festival. It really put together a really great set of local Republicans and regional Republicans to really say, like, she is a part of the emerging Republican dynamic in this area of the country. And it showed that she has a lot of support from, I hesitate to call it the establishment, but I guess the insurgent establishment that has started to kind of take over the Republican scene since 2010.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have any idea of what she's referring to when she says unhinged liberals. I mean, liberal is one thing. That's a political stance. But unhinged is...
It's political red meat. When you go in front of your base, you always call your opponents crazy, evil, and stupid, and your supporters love it. While I don't enjoy hearing the rhetoric, you kind of expect to hear it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, to what extent does what is going on in Washington and the similar words we hear in Washington filter down here to the state level? I mean, is there a connection?
Absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump really got his start in Iowa. He didn't win the caucuses here, but this is where he demonstrated that he was a politically viable candidate. And if you drive out to the rural sections of Iowa, you see a lot of Trump signs. People here support Trump. They support his populist agenda. And Kim Reynolds has to know that if she wants to continue to be the governor of the state, she's got to tap into that energy and power.
Okay, the two of you, we've got just a few seconds left. Cast your eyes forward in this very unpredictable political environment and tell me what you'll be watching, or just waking up and taking in the news and giving up on any kind of predictions, Jonathan.
As a China specialist, I always look to China. And it is, as the U.S. has pulled out of TPP and sort of stepped back from East Asia, China's really stepping up. And so I suspect that we're going to see a more muscular and aggressive Chinese foreign policy in East Asia.
Dave Anderson, your closing words?
I'm interested to continue to watch the Senate, and in particular the security of Mitch McConnell's position as majority leader.
Right. Steve Bannon has it out for him. What did he say? Three scalps now, right? And he's wanting them all to pledge to not reelect him as majority leader. Is that right?
Yeah. And if that changes, Congress changes.
Okay. We'll see. See what happens in the future. Glad to have you two helping us along with your analysis. Dave Anderson, Jonathan Hasid of Iowa State University. Gentlemen, we appreciate you coming into our studio. Thank you so much for the fascinating analysis.
Thanks for having us.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon with help from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Your comments anytime, just send them to our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.